The House Transportation will come to order and welcome everybody. We're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2437. And I'm going to ask Representative Krieger and Representative Roland if they would like to come up.
Go first. Want me to go ahead, Arnie?
Yeah.
I'm ready. Thank
okay.
you. Sorry,
I was thank you. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep of District 1. I want to thank Chair Beyer and the committee for giving the bill a hearing. The concept of a highway from Coos Bay to Ontario has been around before I ran my first session in 2000. John Shank, who will testify today, will give a little history and discuss his work on this project over the last 9 or 10 years. Several changes have taken place from 2000 to now that make this project, I think, even a greater value to the South Coast. Representative Roblin and I worked hard on the airport terminal at Coos Bay, which was successful, and that project is complete and is now serving the South Coast. In 2007, we passed a bonding package that included funds for the Gateway project at Coos Bay. This project envisioned a container terminal port facility with large ships unloading cargo from east and shipping products to the west. Part of that cargo was envisioned to be moved by trucks when the terminal is built. Increased highway access and infrastructure will be needed, and this bill really addresses that issue. This project would also relieve congestion and the bottleneck on I-5 and I-84 in the Portland area for trucks that now have to use those routes only passing through Portland. Security issues will also be addressed. As we saw, I-84 froze up this winter. Trucking was stopped for several days. The Coos Bay to Ontario Highway would provide an alternative route. It would provide direct truck road from the Midwest to move products from our central western states to the coastal ports with direct access to Japan, Malaysia, and other Asian areas. Also, the Port of Coos Bay has just acquired the short rail line from Coos Bay to the Eugene area. This would be a welcome and a needed part of the entire Southern Oregon infrastructure. If Southern Oregon is going to grow, we must develop our infrastructure of transportation, and that includes rail, ocean, this project, and our highways. We have already made the investment in the airport. We've made the investment in the rail. We made the investment with the port bill, the Gateway project, and this would complete the need for the South Coast for the long, long time and create jobs. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Chair, and distinguished members of this committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am representative from House District 9 in Coos Bay. I want to give just a little bit of history of why I think the time is right for this bill. You know, when you look at the expansion of the West, you recognize that rail had a big part of that. That was how do we move people and goods back and forth economically in this country. And the winners and losers were the cities that fought over getting the rail to go through their town or their community, because economically it meant they survived, and those that were just a few miles off that rail generally became the ghost towns of the West and died. Then we had the Second World War, and our General Eisenhower, having spent the time in Germany, recognized that an interstate highway system, as they had in Germany, was essential for the defense of a country. The ability to rapidly move and deploy forces was important. So his first major effort when he came back to this country was to put in the interstate system across our country. And our country invested millions of dollars. But when they did that, they did it not like the rail, where it was deciding different places, but they went and connected the already existing infrastructure that was in the United States. Those places that were prospering and were the industrial centers of the country connected to the other large population areas. They didn't make a determination about where it was, whether it was the right place or the wrong place. They just said, we have a place in San Francisco and we have a place in Sacramento and we need up and down the coast. So they took an already existing infrastructure or idea and connected it with this infrastructure. The issue is, if you look at the West Coast and you look at the ability for us to bring goods back and forth from Asia, we really only have three ports. We have the San Francisco, the Oakland, California, the Los Angeles, Oakland, Long Beach, and then the Seattle Tacoma. Those are the ports. If you look at the East Coast, there's lots of ports. There's a lot of available space to get goods to and from. In our West Coast, that isn't true. And so as you've seen what Representative Krieger mentioned earlier, we've already talked about how we've been working on trying to get our port deepened. We can become the port that has a deep water port that can move traffic and bring in cargo. In fact, the build-out for that project would talk about 2 million containers a year, of which 10% would probably stay on the West Coast. The rest would move across the country. 10%. If that's the case, we're talking about 200,000 containers being distributed in Oregon, producing jobs. We have found what happens when a rail line shuts down. Your industry really gets hurt. You have to have multimodal opportunities. That means the ability of having a road makes a big difference in whether the viability for short periods of time if things go bad, and we know what happens in our weather and whatever, the rail and other things have problems. Having that road makes it even more advantageous if we want to start deciding where growth should happen in this state. And from my perspective, if you look at the geology of our place, the only place where we can really have an international deep water port is Coos Bay. Therefore, we have to decide if we want to be a player in that economy to have the infrastructure that goes with it. That includes a major highway along with rail. And I encourage you to consider this. If we had had this ready to go now, would it be something that we'd be talking about on the national level with respect to stimulus packages and yep. constructions? I believe it is. So the issue is here, how do we get ready to take advantage of those opportunities that would come forward? And I say that the way to do that is to pass House Bill 2437. And I would love to answer any questions you might have.
Well, committee, this is our chance, right? Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. So thank you guys, for representatives, for bringing this. I totally, completely, and wholeheartedly not only support the study, but the highway. The Erie Canal, the Transcontinental Railroad, Interstate Highway System, the Tennessee Valley Administration, the Bonneville Power Administration, I'm sure the Rural Electrification Act. I could go on and on and on and on about things that have made this country the best and the strongest and the richest country in the world. And if any of those projects today, if we were trying to do that today, you know what? We couldn't do it. Because this whole country has gotten bass-ackwards on what's good and what isn't good. Those were all good things, and this is a good thing. It's going to bring jobs. It's going to help our economic security, national security, probably reduce carbon emissions when you think about it, because you'll be able to get from one point to the other in a faster time using less fuel. But I wish you luck, because you got this incredible tidal wave of opposition that, be quite frank with you, and that all the people in that wave would directly benefit from what you're trying to do, and they don't even know it. So I support you completely. I wish you well, and I really appreciate you bringing this here to us.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, you may be aware that for a couple of sessions now, I've been associated with Oregon Inc., and we have had a huge discussion about wave energy and its potential. And I think it feeds in here because the South Coast is ripe for being just right for producing energy from wave action. And what's needed and what is under a lot of study right now is the right sort of mix in the technology. But what we do know is it's going to take buoys. And if your waves are there, then the industry to build those buoys, we're hoping, will be there. And that's another reason why we need access, because I think the potential for some really good manufacturing of a great renewable energy resource is right there and ready to go, just a matter of time. So I hope this highway scheme advances along with the technology of getting a renewable energy from our ocean waves and the manufacturing that goes with it, which we are on the cutting edge of. So thank you for this bill.
Chair Beyer and Representative Berger, probably going where Representative Rowland was going to go, but American Bridge is right at Reedsport. That's where the test buoys are going to be. It is on the rail line. And you would not, because of the size of these things, you couldn't take and construct them at a far distance away and put them even on a rail car and get them there. They're that big. So they're going to have to be manufactured locally. And you've got a company that's a worldwide company that has the capacity. They've got the engineering. They've got a rail. And they've got a port that they can get them out on barge to get them planted. So it, here again, it's just every time you look at this thing, you find something new that is very valuable. We've got part of that infrastructure in place. We just need to continue.
And I was going to add that the American Bridge has had a really difficult time since our rail went out because their long span girders they were making don't go around corners that trucks do. And so even having the big freeway would have helped them get the stuff. Watching them come through Coos Bay, the ones that they can bring, is pretty remarkable. But I don't know how many people have driven the road to drain in it. The drain, you have to make a pretty right angle turn. You can't get them around certain corners. So they've had to cut back. They've lost contracts because of the shipping costs and also the fact that they can't move them from there to here. And this would be that backup. You have to have redundant systems if you're going to make things economically work.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As somebody who makes the drive to Coos Bay frequently, I find the proposal very interesting. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on including in a feasibility study questions around who pays for the roads and whether or not tolling or congestion pricing would be some sort of option for funding.
I would be absolutely encouraged that to happen. And I think that if you talk to the Grange, you'll talk to them. They've talked about it at different times as well. So it's about having the opportunity to get it done. And I certainly look at any of those things put in the study would be fine from my perspective.
Chair Beyer, Representative Bale, that actually was originally going to be called the toll road from Coos Bay to Ontario, and they envisioned, I think, when Grange people get up here, that it would be a toll road. Now, what we have to go over now are some combination of something, but a lot of the infrastructure on Highway 20 is simply widening it. It's not like starting over, and I think that's probably Mr. Shane can address that a lot of existing road is already in place. They just have to re-engineer it and widen it.
And there is actually another total right-of-way. The old wagon road is a more direct route directly to Roseburg and the east. So, I mean, and that right-of-way exists today. It's still there. So there are opportunities to look at options.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With all due respect to you guys, the only way I could support this is if you start on the Ontario end.
You had an opportunity.
You don't have a deep water port there.
Oahu.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
We have a Snake River, which is deep for eastern Oregon. my question to you is this. I am curious what it is. I'm not that familiar with Coos Bay as a port, but is it large enough to manage these anticipated monster container ships that are now being built? And if so, does it have some sort of inherent advantage, therefore, over Portland? And I guess Portland, is that its competition?
The answer to the question is that the bill that we put in, that we worked on last time, which was to get the dredging money so we could dredge it to 50 feet, 52, means that it could handle those ships that are coming, the biggest ones being made today. The Coast Guard has also said that they can make the corner into Coos Bay. They can make that turn. So the answer is yes, we do have, it can be deep enough. Currently, it's not. But it is not in competition with Portland because Portland's working now at getting to 42 feet. It's basalt. We have sandstone bottom. They have indicated that it doesn't cost much, $120 million to dredge the bay to get it to this place we need. When they were looking at our port and Maersk came in and had chosen this place, they've actually bought the rights to the land portion of it. They actually haven't bought them. They have a contract with the port that they should get first rights on building a port there. Their issue is that they can make an exceptionally efficient cargo offload there with less space because you can build the train as you're doing it, build the train in the boat that comes across you, locate it, so you don't need quite as much storage space. But they estimated between 2 and 4 million containers a year they could handle out of the port. And it does take the bigger ships. That's why it needs to be deeper. But it was over $1 billion in Canada and another close to $1 billion in Mexico to get the same depth because of the structure underneath.
Chair Beyer, Representative Vance. It was obvious when we had a briefing, and Representative Roblin was there from Marist, and they talked about all the potential on the coast. They want to come to Coos Bay. Now, because of the world economy, that's going to be let up maybe a couple years before they really start moving forward, and then there's work to do on the environmental side and the Corps getting all the permits to do all these things. That's what the first $5 million is that they're spending. But definitely for me, I can't think of anything we can do during the time that I've been here that would be better, because you're talking not just a couple hundred jobs, you're talking thousands of jobs. That would mean that the South Coast could be putting some money back to Salem instead of the other way around.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, with all due respect, I think the real reason that Maersk is coming to Coos Bay is there's too many Finns up in Astoria, and they're mostly Danes. My comment was...
That's against the law in this state, Representative.
My apologies to all the Danish people in the audience. I'm Swedish. I can say anything.
You could say bad things about both groups, Danes and Finns. You could say bad things about Danes and Finns. Your comment was disparaging on both the Danish and the Finns. Because you were Swede, you could do that.
Yeah.
Those of us who are Finn-Swede have a harder time.
It's really hard. I'm Finn-Dane, so I'm okay. excuse me, Swedish-Dane. My question, getting back to that, is and I apologize if I came in a few minutes late and you covered this, but have you approached the South Coast Act or Area Committee on Transportation and how this would fit in with your transportation planning? Has that gone that far yet?
You're talking about the work group that Representative, it's Commissioner Morgan now is working with on the South Coast that put, mm-hmm. for instance, this last time we met, the rail project was the most important project. Once that's kind of been said, I have no doubt in my mind if that was brought up there, which we will do, it would rate very high for the South Coast.
I think that the bigger thing for like ACT, which is different from our South Coast other group, you know, they're looking at what existing structures we have and how do we make it better. This is more of a visionary deal, and so it's not really something that they have necessarily talked about. The Grange has had this on their agenda for, I don't know, John Shank can explain that, but I think it's at least a decade, and having conversations about this. But so I don't think it's gotten to their level, because they look at how could we improve what we have, not coming up with a whole new solution.
Okay. Very follow-up. It's very exciting, and I would support it wholeheartedly.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I guess you guys are free to go back to your committees.
Thank you very much.
And then I'm going to call up Phyllis Wilson and John Shank and Dave Hennigan, if you all want to come up together.
I like that. We could start a rumor. Yeah. I was going
to
bring your
pillows. You're welcome to
just
get started.
Good afternoon. My name is Phyllis Wilson. I am the president of the Oregon State Grange, and I'm here to speak to you this afternoon on House Bill 2437. Chair Beyer and very distinguished members of this committee. I have to top Mr. Roblin on that. I will read to you the information I want to present to you this afternoon. I believe you have the handout now. Mm-hmm. The Oregon State Grange is in support of House Bill 2437 and has been for the past 10 years or more, advocated for an east-west alternative highway from Coos Bay to Ontario, or for Representative Vance from Ontario to Coos Bay. An east-west alternative has been discussed in many of the communities of our state and here in our capital, but the concept has never officially had a feasibility study applied. With the redevelopment of the port of Coos Bay, it is time to look at an alternative east-west transportation route for travel and shipping. With the probability of increased population in Portland and the Willamette Valley, increased demand for farmland conservation, conversion, excessive traffic congestion in and around Portland, and increased travel safety concerns, it is time to find a feasible alternative. The development of an alternative east-west route from Coos Bay to Ontario would provide economic returns to Oregon from the beginning of the project and into the predictable future. The alternative would also provide construction cost reductions, improve highway safety, and provide better access to our rural communities in central and eastern Oregon, providing them with greater opportunities for growth and tourism. Even in these economically challenged times, and as the governor prepares his Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009, it is time to include this feasibility study in preparation for transportation improvements and economic development in Oregon. And I ask you to please support HB 2437. On a personal note, just so that you know, I do live in Coos County, which is the South Coast, and am very, very much in favor of this House bill. And if you've traveled Highway 38 or Highway 42, you know then how vital this route would be to ease the transportation burden that we currently have there. And thank you very much.
Thank you. John, if you want to go ahead and get started. Well, okay. You two decide who wants to talk.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. This isn't a land use bill. It's nice to be in front of the Transportation Committee and not the Land Use Committee. Not that there's anything wrong with the Land Use Committee. We send out an email just before every session to our membership saying, okay, what is it that you think is important? What is it that you want us to address at the legislature this upcoming session? And I received an email probably from a joint member with the Grange on this very issue, and seeing that need to address it in our current economic climate. We asked Representative Krieger and Representative Roblin to bring this bill forward and are very excited about it. I won't go into the details. We'll let Mr. Shank, who's been working this issue for far longer than I have, go into the details. But I can tell you very briefly, I spent some time last week in Representative Bence's district in Burns, Ontario, and I started in Bend and then worked my way over on 20 to Burns in Ontario. The road, Highway 20, is the obvious location for this route from Bend to Ontario. I don't know how many of you have been from Bend to Burns. It's straight, it's flat, and there's plenty of room for widening. And then when you work your way, it's about 2 hours from Bend to Burns, and then it's another 2 hours from Burns to Ontario. And as you go through both Burns, which just lost the Monaco coach jobs that they had in Burns, and then you work your way into Vail, all you see through downtown Burns and Vail is empty storefronts. It's really sad. I didn't grow up in that area. I grew up in St. Helens, but I see the same thing over there that I do in St. Helens, where I grew up. The empty storefronts and not a lot of economic activity. You get into Ontario then, where you're right on 84, and it's like a completely different world, even though Vail is, I think, about 15 miles from Ontario. So this bill, from an economic development standpoint in Harney County in the Burns area with 16% unemployment, would be huge. If we can get the funding, then it's my commitment to working, I'm sure, with some of you to get to go to the federal government to work with Representatives DeFazio on trying to get the, and Walden, on trying to get the funding at the federal level for this. So that's it. That's our interest in the bill. We're very excited about it and hope that it will pass. And as far as the details, I'm happy to turn those over to Mr. Shank.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. If I can, I must tell you that the previous speakers, including the two representatives, have covered a lot of my thunder, so I'll try not to rehash what they said and maybe answer more of your questions. But this project began in LaGrange in 1996. At that time, perhaps I should introduce myself, excuse me. My name is John Shank, U.S. Navy Civil Engineer Corps, retired, and former legislative director of the Oregon State Grange, and a founder of Road PAC, which was a political action committee we established about 10 years ago to help fund the videos and the advertising that we had going. Now, that PAC has since went defunct. But the project developed when the Grange got together, and we were looking for a focal issue that would kind of build on the tradition that the Grange had, which was things like the rural free delivery and different things like that, which the Grange initiated in years past. And we were looking for something we could build around. So this project evolved partly because we saw a need to protect prime farmland, which is disappearing in the Willamette Valley, which is the only prime farmland in the state. We were looking at economic development aspects in the rural parts of Oregon, and there were a number of other issues that we looked at, and it culminated in coming up with this project. Now, I had recently driven through the eastern states on a trip prior to us getting into this process, and had come across the road called the Daniel Boone Parkway in Kentucky. And what struck me at the time, as all of us South Coast residents who regularly drive 38 and 42 and are not happy about it, what struck me was that here was a parkway in a rural part of Kentucky that had a huge number of logging trucks, big coal trucks, and I'll tell you, it was like being behind an aircraft carrier if you ever get behind one of them things. They are just huge. And it was a two-lane road. But it was a parkway. It was a freeway-type road. It had very limited access. In its 140-mile length, there were four places you could get on and off. And it allowed truck traffic, even though it went through a very rugged part of Kentucky. If any of you have been to eastern Kentucky, you know what I'm talking about. It's very similar to our Coast Range. But because they didn't have to worry about driveways, school zones, and all of that business, these trucks were able to handle the hills and everything fine. All the hills had passing lanes so that the trucks could not, you know, wouldn't slow down other traffic and everything. So as this project developed, I had in the back of my mind my experience on this parkway. And currently, for your information, both Representatives Roblin and Krieger have a video that was made by Road PAC and LaGrange some 10 years ago. And although it's 10 years old, if you haven't seen that video, I'd recommend you take a look at it. It addresses a lot of the issues. It has some cuts in there of that parkway I'm talking about, and you can visually see what this did. Now, prior to getting out of the Navy and being in the Civil Engineer Corps, I had some experience with some studies that were being made on West Coast ports. You know, we like to call the Port of Coos Bay an international port, but that's a misnomer. You don't have an international port when you can't go anywhere. And once you unload your cargo in Coos Bay, the reality is you can't go anywhere with it. And one of the things we saw by starting this road at Coos Bay rather than Newport or Brookings or some other places is we had a port there, and the port's perfectly fine. Yes, we need some dredging, but you're talking about 3 miles of dredging, not the 100 or whatever it is up to Portland. Somebody raised a question about competition with Portland, and I assure you Coos Bay Port will never be in competition with Portland. For number one, they got a lock on the grain trade that we're never going to have because we don't have any barges coming down to Coos Bay with grain. But if we could get some of the container traffic in there, it'd make a huge difference. When I first moved into Coos Bay in the 70s, we had a very thriving harbor operation, a lot of longshoremen and related auxiliary businesses that went with that. Now the few longshoremen we still have living there travel to Portland and to L.A. and to Seattle for jobs. We've went from some 400 ships a year down to, if we get 30 or 40 a year, we're doing good. And I, you know, I just ask you to think about that to realize what the impact has been. Representative Arn Roblin mentioned the bridge company in Reedsport. And they have, you know, they were shipping girders with the rail system nationwide. But you can't, you just literally cannot haul them things on the designated freight highways 48, 42, and 38. It's impossible. We've got right angle turns all through those two routes. You're going through school zones. You're going through small towns. And they are now limited to basically bidding on jobs within the state. And their workforce is dramatically reduced. The lumber companies are having problems because now that the rail line is out of action, they're having to ship stuff they used to rail. So a rail line is important, but an interstate connection is vital, and you need that. And you need a new road. You are never going to be able to upgrade 38 or 42 because the driveways exist. The houses exist. You're not going to get rid of those driveways. Even if you found a way to chop out the cliffs that you'd have to chop out and all that, you just aren't going to do it.
So I have a question. So.
Yes.
Oh, I'm willing to wait, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. All right.
One other thing I'd just like to touch on. In the last 10 years since we brought this project up, we've tried to get gas lines through, and we finally got a gas line built after a lot of hassle on a route. There was talk about bringing a new power line, and that got defeated because of environmental issues and everything. We envision this highway being an infrastructure corridor. When you build it with a big enough right-of-way that when we want to build a gas line, you already got a right-of-way. When you want to put in an electric power line, you already have the right-of-way. And then you don't have three and four and five different routes going through the environment and chewing everything up. Just plan it. You know, we like to talk about planned growth, but I don't know that we're planning very well because I keep seeing farmland getting built over in Willamette Valley. So let's do some planning. As far as urban sprawl goes, when you have an expressway, whether it's a freeway, a toll road, or whatever it is, you control whether there's any sprawl. Because the only place you're going to have any growth is on the access points. And by the state buying up the development rights around that, you can absolutely control any sprawl if that's an issue. As far as financing, you know, my research of all the states that have got into the expressway freeway business has just come up with so much innovation, it's mind-boggling. Maine came up with something very innovative. They sold bonds to citizens in $1,000 units. Imagine the market that opened up where an average citizen could buy a bond for $1,000. You know, I can afford that, you know. You don't have to rely on big banks and big corporations. When DOT makes its study, I'm sure it's going to look very expensive. But something some of the other states have done as far as land acquisition goes, when you're building, you know, a new road through public lands or large private land holdings, you can do what Kentucky did. Make agreements. For instance, take Weyerhaeuser. If you want to go through Weyerhaeuser land, just tell them, hey, we will give you a lock gate that when you do a harvest, you will have access to that freeway. And in return, we want a good deal on the land. There's any number of innovative things you can do, and I'm going to stop there because I know there's questions and I can ramble forever.
Well, I know one. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. I tend to go on myself so I can sympathize, especially about things that are such great ideas as this. You know, the things you ran up against on your gas line, which I would support, your transmission line power line, which I would support too, this goes anywhere, we will run up against all of that. And then when you add on a good-sized highway and then a right-of-way for a power transmission, and you're going to need another right-of-way for, in all likelihood, for any kind of gas, you're talking about a pretty wide right-of-way. God knows it'd be hundreds of feet wide. Not that I'm saying that's a bad idea, because it's a good, smart idea, because you only have one fight to fight the whole way. But on what you're going to compete with, you're right. We always will, I hope, have barges going down the Columbia. There's some things that could happen that would, if we start tearing out dams on the Columbia, that number could reduce too. They'd probably, in all likelihood, send a lot of grain to Tacoma. It probably would be Tacoma and Long Beach that you'd be competing with, because you don't have the 90-mile trip up the river. I just want to tell you, I thoroughly, completely, and absolutely support this concept and this highway, and I hope I live to see the day I get to drive down it. So good luck to you, though. They're going to need it.
Representative Widener.
Question for Mr. Honeycutt here. What do you think if, just starting off, we just did like light rail and a bike trail? Just kidding, Dave.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It's a long, Madam Chair, Representative,
a long Rogers, bike
a
ride.
Long bike ride from Bend to Ontario. It's so, 4 hours by car, and I was driving about 75.
Have you guys came up with an amount for the study, or where you think it should be?
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, ODOT was quoted in the Bend Bulletin. They did an article on this bill about a month ago. ODOT was quoted with a figure of $150,000 to do the study.
And Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. We do have, surprised I didn't provide this for members, or maybe we did provide this for members. Thank you. You have fiscal analysis attached to your testimony that includes an estimated general fund impact of $141,340 for the feasibility study. More on top of that than
yeah,
I thought
you
it was,
were,
Madam Chair.
See? Any other questions? Seeing none, I have a couple, and I think I when I talked to Representative Krieger, I was talking to him a little bit, but on the route that you had envisioned and the size of road that you had been originally looking at?
Well, based on the traffic information I got from DOT when I was first doing some of the studies on this, we determined that the original traffic load would probably not justify more than an initial two-lane highway, which I would point out that not only is the Daniel Boone Parkway two-lane, but the West Virginia Turnpike started out as a two-lane as a two-lane road. And then as traffic loads increased, of course, that eventually got expanded. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, on the size of the road.
Ideally, what we saw would be ideal, and the beautiful thing is you don't have to build it all at one shot. The two segments that would be new construction completely, would be from Coos Bay to I-5, making that first connection. And then also where we would go up I-5 and then take existing 58 through Oak Ridge and up over the hill. That road is in pretty good shape. I was over that 2-3 years ago, and DOT's done a good job of keeping that maintained and broadened. But to get a straighter shot, from the junction of 58 and 97, we would want a new road built from there over to the Burns area to tie into 20. Which would, again, pretty much make you a straight shot at that. Eventually, again, as loads justified it and people could see that we would consider a connection then from the connection at I-5 on to Oak Ridge to bypass that jog, you know. But initially, we'd be looking at two segments, Coos Bay to I-5 and the junction of 5897 to somewhere in the Burns region. And ultimately, as you'll see when you view the video we made, we envision this just being the beginning of a modernization of roads throughout, but eventually seeing a series of roads both across the Coast Range and throughout the state of Oregon. Because really, as was pointed out by the two representatives with their initial speakers, if you're not on an interstate, it's a dream that you're going to get any economic development anywhere. But not only do businesses need that, but people don't want to be isolated. I mean, they want to go to the opera or big city for shopping and that sort of thing, too. So while it's essential for industry, it'd be nice to not have to drive 4 hours to get from from Coos Bay to the city.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, I have never driven that 58. that I can remember. How far is it from that 5897 junction up to Bend?
To Bend?
I can't answer that.
If you, I can't, but he says he can.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, it's about an hour and a half from 58 comes down, hooks up with 97 at pretty close to Crescent Lake.
Okay.
So it's about another hour and a half north up through Bend. Okay. And then there's a parkway that's already built in Bend. If this does go up, if it goes up 97 through Bend, there's a parkway, an expressway through that gets you around Bend.
My thinking, Madam Chair, is that if we're, you're absolutely right, the critical new infrastructure is Coos Bay to I-5. And then I'm thinking if we could start there, you know, and do in segments. I've many times driven between Bend, Burns, Ontario, and that's a pretty straight shot. Good, used to be good highway. I haven't been on it for a while. So I'm just thinking of staging this thing and what the legs would be.
One thought that hit us as we were looking at different options of putting this thing together is it takes roughly now at a legal speed limit, it's roughly a 10 to 12 hour drive from Coos Bay to the Idaho border. And we would anticipate with this road you could knock that down to about 8 hours. And if that seems unrealistic, I would point out that the West Virginia Turnpike, when it was built, was around 96 miles, and I'm doing this off my head, and I'm out of practice. I haven't done a presentation in a while. Had 89 bridges in those 96 miles. It only shortened the route by 20 miles, but saved 2 hours.
Madam Chair,
additional?
The goal, I'd like to point out, the goal is Ontario, not Idaho.
Well, it's...
Okay, let's just keep that really clear.
Definitely Ontario, because we don't want to get interstate jurisdictions, amongst other things.
Representative Bailey.
With that final comment, you may have actually just addressed my question, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. Does it make sense, as long as we're looking at a feasibility study, to look at alternative routes or configurations? And with all due respect to Representative Bence, is there a reason why Ontario and not Winnemucca, for example, or something like that?
Well, one of the studies I did, and I'm sorry I didn't find my original briefing book. You have to realize that this surprised me. I was just getting ready to go on a vacation when I got a call from Representative Krieger and said, we're resurrecting your highway. And I said, well, I'm on my way to California. So, and all this stuff's been stuffed away for about almost 10 years. But please, the question again.
The question was, does it make sense to study alternative configurations and routes? And for why Coos Bay to Ontario and not Coos Bay to Winnemucca or Coos Bay to somewhere else?
We took some information from, and I forget which bank it was that used to regularly put out information on industry, populations, economics. And there has been over the years a lot of talk in Coos Bay about a road to Winnemucca. Mm-hmm. And I was always puzzled because I'd look at a map and I'd say, what's in Winnemucca? Nothing there. And so we did a comparison on the populations and the economic activities of, say, Boise as opposed to Winnemucca. And it was a slam dunk that there's a lot more people, a lot more economic activity, all of those things, plus a road to Ontario, which gets you into Boise, goes right through the middle of Oregon, which is going to affect our economy a lot more than following the southern route. And a lot of that same distance would end up being in Nevada then, and you have no control over what Nevada does. So that was really our thinking on that.
Follow-up comment, Madam Chair? I don't know which route is better, if any route is a good route to go, and I think that's part of the point of the feasibility study. I would make the observation that perhaps it would be useful to have a wider band of inquiry when we go into this process, because often feasibility studies turn up data that one would not expect at the beginning.
In our video, we show an expansion with the upgrade of 97 over to 210, which runs up to Spokane, which we think would take a lot of the truck traffic off of I-5, quite honestly. And redundancy is really an issue here, too. You know, we talk about the snowstorm. Somebody mentioned the snowstorm we had this winter. But, you know, we asked a question in our video, what would have happened if the south end of the volcano had blown instead of the north end? We might still be digging out I-5.
Comment?
Chair Beyer, in response to Representative Bailey's question, prior to the Grange becoming involved in this and determining that Ontario to Coos Bay would be the best route, there years before that, there had been talk about such a road, but going to and from or through Winnemucca, and that had been dismissed because of a variety of reasons. And when the Grange became involved, it was the fact that Coos Bay to Ontario was the most logical route.
Representative Schaffler.
You know, in 1990, I was working on a finishing crew where we were finally putting the final touches on a bridge crossing the Toutle River that was taken out by that volcano, and it literally could have buried I-5 and would have never replaced it. But that wasn't, you know, I've driven from Bend down south and then turned over and went through Roseburg and went to, I think it was Reedsport, and then down to Gold Beach several years ago at another committee. But when I was driving through there, I was driving through National Forest almost the whole way. And when you talk about funding this highway, if the federal government, in all their wisdom, eventually the wood fiber industry, the timber industry, the lumber industry is going to come back. This is the center of the universe for lumber. And it's the most sustainable place in the world to grow it, harvest it, mill it, and then do that again. And if they let us back on that land, we could be funding a lot more projects like this. So I hope you tie that into, I don't know how we could tie that in there, but and it's either that or watch it burn up and rot. So I always tie that into everything we do in here, so forgive me.
Funding, if I may say this, funding is really less of an issue. One of the experiences I had in my career in the Navy, you know, in every government institution, there's always what you call end-of-the-year money. We all heard about end-of-the-year money. Everybody saves a little reserve, and at the end of the year, the trick is how to get rid of it. And I built my career on having shovel-ready projects, because I had contracting authority, that I could put on the street within 30 days, and I always got a big chunk of that end-of-the-year money, and it was for legitimate projects. I wish we had done a study 10 years ago, and Governor Kuligowski could go down there and see his friend Obama right now and say, we have a shovel-ready project to build this road. How about letting us get into this money that's available now? And I only hope that in 10 years or less, when the next big bunch of money comes up, that we're maybe ready to do that.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, just as an aside, and building on Representative Bailey's remarks, the McDermott Winnemucca route is still in my district. In fact, the only thing that on that part of the state that isn't in my district is halfway, right on the other side of halfway, because halfway is, which I don't think is a logical exit strategy for this east end of the road. And just about whatever I agree that the broader the study, the better. But to me, the challenging part is on the coast side. The eastern part is all pretty flat, and I think it is going to be Ontario for all the reasons you've mentioned. But I fully support your concept. It's just that a lot of space between today and that actually happening, I think.
I'm sorry.
A lot of space between where we are today and seeing this project actually happen.
That's true, but it starts with this bill.
Yeah.
Thank you. No other questions? Thank you. I appreciate your coming to testify. And I have Jerry Bohart from ODOT, and she wants to come forward. Welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Jerry Bohart. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator. Thank you, Chair Byer, and committee members. Just briefly, House Bill 2437 requires the Department of Transportation to study the feasibility of constructing a highway between Coos Bay and Ontario that goes through Bend. A similar study was conducted for House Bill 3090, which was passed during the 1999 session. And House Bill 3090, Section 3, contained the following provision. The Department of Transportation shall begin a study on the construction of an extension of Interstate 82 south of Umatilla to the California or Nevada border. And the study did not include the feasibility of a specific alignment based on environmental geometric design or other detailed information. The study did not provide an in-depth analysis of design alternatives or estimate the cost of construction of the facility. Should House Bill 2437 become law, ODOT would construct a study similar to that of House Bill 3090. That was passed. And the general merits of the new facility would be compared to the existing system performance between Coos Bay and Ontario. Typical to what we did for House Bill 3090, a technical advisory committee would develop the purpose, needs, and objectives of the study and would provide oversight and review of the analysis conducted by the staff for the study. The committee would develop one conceptual highway design alternative, likely to be a combination of existing and new highway alignments. Then the analysis would be a conceptual corridor level and not include feasibility of specific alignments based on environmental, geometric, or design considerations. And the study would not provide in-depth analysis of the design alternatives or the estimate of the cost of constructing of such a facility, nor would it contain a public outreach element to garner input from stakeholders. Then the results of this feasibility study would be provided to the Interim House and Senate Committee related to transportation no later than December 1 of 2010, and at that time the Interim House and Senate Committees related to transportation will determine if further study is warranted. And then further study would include the detailed analysis regarding location, environmental, geometric, and other detailed evaluations. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Schaffler.
I think if we ever did get anywhere near doing this, just figuring out how and where and how much and who and when, we're talking tens of millions of dollars. Am I being too liberal in my actual get right down to it?
Chair Beyer. Representative Schaffler, I'm not an engineer. I couldn't tell you the cost estimates, although I've heard anywhere within the range of probably $7 to $10 billion is what would be anticipated.
Madam Chair,
follow up, please.
That's $1 billion. That's actual construction, though, right?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's actual construction. Oh,
forgive me, Madam Chair. I meant just studying a real thorough study of right of way, how much it would cost. Figuring out what purchases need to be made and land acquisition, even that would be in the tens of millions, I think.
Madam Chair, Representative, what would probably occur as the next step is something like a major investment study, which typically does run between $3 and $5 million.
Just one last thing. We got a bridge that for whatever reason is going to cost us, they say now $4 billion. Lord knows what it'll be when we're done. Just across the river up there, I think I would love to do this. I want to do this, but it would be more than $7 billion. Probably $70 billion. That's just pure speculation.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me help you a little bit here, Mr. Schaffler, Representative Schaffler. Newburgh-Dundee Bypass is $11 million for 12 miles, so there's a mathematical. That's just for environmental impact studies, and that's not even building any roads, so there's some math you can use for calculating how much this would cost.
Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, that being said, a journey of 1 million miles starts with a step.
Amen.
Until we visualize what Oregon would look like with the transportation corridor here, we aren't, you know, you don't get energy behind an idea until that idea is put forward and we see the possibilities. So that's what we're about here, and I think it's good effort.
And that's why my name's on the bill, Madam Chair.
Mine too.
Maybe we could chop off a few lanes of that bridge and fund part of this road.
We ain't doing that right now.
Thank you. And no other questions? Appreciate it. And then I have Doug Riggs, who would like to say a couple words here. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, through record, Doug Riggs, on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities, which is Redmond, Bend, Madras, Prineville, Maupin, Sisters, Culver, Metolius, and Lapine. And so this proposal would go right through the middle of our Central Oregon cities, and so we've had an eye on this bill since it was introduced. Let me start out by saying that there isn't a transportation funding package that we've not supported in the last 15 years. We've supported OTIA 1, 2, and 3. We've been strong supporters of Connect Oregon 1, 2, and hopefully 3, which we'll see coming up. We believe that we need to have some sort of a package this year, and we're hopeful the committee here and in the Senate, the Ways and Means Committee, will work on something, so we're strong supporters. But we do have a couple things that I'd like to point out. I sent this out to my 9 cities and councilors and managers here a few weeks ago and expected to hear back a resounding, yes, we support this, let's go ahead. Instead, what I heard back from them was pretty interesting, which is the fact that they don't have the money to repair the potholes in their streets. The fact that they don't have the money to repair and repave the state highways that come through their cities. And you can go, you know, through downtown Redmond, and you see 5th and 6th Streets, which are Highway 97, basically falling apart. They don't have money to maintain intersections. So this is, there's a huge funding crisis in cities in the state, and the LOC testified before this committee on this earlier. So when a proposal comes to spend $7 billion or $70 billion when we can't come up with $70 million to maintain roads in Oregon, city managers, transportation, and public safety directors start scratching their heads a little bit. Not to say it shouldn't be done, but we need to at least make sure that we're putting maintenance and operations of our existing system as priority number one. The second is an issue I've talked to a number of you on, and several of you have co-sponsored a bill, which hopefully will come out of the printing presses here in the next couple of days, and that is on the transportation planning rule. Currently, under the transportation planning rule, cities are penalized for growing. We are prohibited from rezoning properties or bringing new land into our UGBs if our vehicle mobility standards are exceeded. And this is a change that was made by LCDC and by ODOT in 2005. And so right now in Bend, in Redmond, in Madras, and in Prineville, we're facing moratoriums on growth because our vehicle mobility standards on the Bend Parkway, the Redmond Bypass, Highway 97 through Madras are exceeded. Now, for any of you living in the Portland area, I would argue that through going through Portland in rush hour traffic, that's exceeding the vehicle mobility standards. Going through downtown Redmond on the bypass, brand new bypass, where there may be 5 cars within, you know, 800 yards of you, is not exceeding vehicle mobility standards. But the current state rules are prohibiting growth. Now, why does that apply to this? If we have several thousand more vehicles coming into our city limits and using our state highway system through our towns, and we're already exceeding our vehicle mobility standards, we can't expand the UGB and we can't rezone property, so we can't create jobs. Imagine what will happen if this project goes through. So if this is going through and there's money for it, and if this is going through and we change the state policy to stop punishing cities for growing, then that would be acceptable. And I'm hoping that the bill will be ready for you to take a look at here in a couple weeks. And the last thing I'll point out, and ODOT addressed it to a certain extent, is that if there's going to be a study, we want to be at the table. I'd like my Bend and Prineville and Lapine people especially to be, you know, at the seats, at the tables, in the discussions, and discussing these types of issues when it's going through the process. So we don't object to spending money on transportation. We strongly support new transportation projects. Transportation projects create jobs. We're all for jobs. They pay good wages, and we're happy to help. But we need to think of this in the larger context, and starting with the TPR and revising the TPR would be an excellent place to start. Thanks.
Thank you. Any comments? I don't see any. Thank you. And then I found one more person, Bill Cluding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Let's take a quick walk backwards a little bit. What's wrong with our state? We're looking at a $3 billion shortfall coming up here in a year or so. But what's happened to our state is we've lost our industrial workers. That's what's went wrong in this state of Oregon. We've lost tens and tens of thousands. In my industry alone, especially in the South Coast, I lost over 3,000 members just in a few years. the big shopping mall in Minnesota, you know, when they went to build that, there was so many skeptics that nobody would put a store in there, nobody would build a road to it. You know how they sold that thing? They got the big sign out front that says, "You build it, they'll come." That's what will happen with this road. We're talking thousands and thousands of jobs just in the Coos Bay area. And you put the big shipping center on I-5, another one over in Ontario, another one at Bend. No telling how many jobs that's going to create. Yeah, we're looking down the road, and it's going to take money. Who would have ever thought you'd see the day when an environmental impact study would cost as much per mile to build a mile of road? Who would have thought we'd ever see that day? And I'll be right frank. Some of these environmental things is what's caused Oregon to be put where it is today. Let's take a good look at this bill. Again, we'll build it, they'll come. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2437. And committee, we're going to go ahead and open an informational hearing on the BMT. I'm waiting for all those people that follow you around and
and
the helicopters and the
Patrick, I'm not sure how big it is.
Yeah.
I do.
It does seem like two teams.
Yeah. Thankfully, Katie knows more about it than I do. She's still coming up. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, call this up somewhere.
Picture of current Highway 20. Function F8 or function F7 or there we go. All set.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Whitty. I'm the manager of the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding at the Oregon Department of Transportation. I've given this a version of this presentation to about half of you from time to time, but I have a different presentation this time with new slides and action slides and
It'd be more exciting.
So now you have to pay attention. Yeah. Spot the difference.
Do action figures.
Spot the difference.
Every time you find one.
I don't think we need that.
There's a difference.
Hang on a sec. Let's go read that thing.
Yeah, that's different.
Well,
just anchor mouth.
I'm having trouble getting that. I can't find the mouse.
So I'm afraid to tell her how much more IS text gets
right.
than we get.
Sorry about that, Madam Chair. The whole issue of the project for a mileage charge to replace the gas tax began with the Road User Fee Task Force, which was an legislatively directed task force. It was actually a bill passed in 2001 that created this task force. And four members of the legislature have been appointed to this task force ever since, including the chair of this committee as a current member. Those legislators helped to guide us through this process. The purpose, legislative purpose, is right there in the slide to develop an alternative system for the current system, which is basically the gas tax, as I'm sure this committee well knows more than anyone else. Task force met nine times in the first year and decided that a distance-based charge would be the most effective way to replace the gas tax, and it made several policy directives to ODOT in designing the new system. One, that it must cover all motorists, like the gas tax does. It must protect the privacy of Oregon motorists. And that came up in the very first meeting, that we have privacy protected in the new system. There'd be a gas tax credit, so no one would pay both. There would be low capital costs for the system, low operating cost for the system, because the gas tax is a very low operating cost system. And then finally, that it be enforceable. The ODOT designed a system for collection of the mileage charge at the fuel pump. So the collection of the data of miles traveled and the fee payment would occur at the fuel pump. And in doing so, we did comply with those legislative directives. It would cover all motorists. It would protect the location privacy of motorists. It does integrate with the fuel tax system. It is affordable, and the enforcement is simple in that no one, if they didn't pay the mileage charge, they wouldn't get their gasoline. ODOT was able to add a couple other features to the system. It's now a familiar payment option, so motorists are familiar with going to the gas pump and paying gas tax, and they simply pay the mileage charge there now. It's also motorist-friendly in that the motorist simply sits at the pump and pays something different. They don't do anything more demanding than they do there. And finally, the gas tax provides redundancy. If there was power outage or something like that, some difficulty, there's redundancy, you can shift back to the gas tax. Now, this is the technology configuration of the system, and that looks rather complicated. But I want to point out to you that this is, in the test we did of it in the pilot project, it was no more problematic or difficult than a credit card transaction. It was just as fast as a credit card transaction. Now, I'll go through some of the pieces here. We had a device in the car that collected signals from the global satellite system, so that the device could locate itself in the car. And then, the purpose of that was location of the device in the car, so that the car could know where it was, which state it was, basically, which zone it was driving in. And so, it collected miles in that particular zone. And then, if it drove into a different zone, say out of state, it would collect miles in that zone. Then those mileage totals would be transferred to a mileage reader at the fuel pump by a wireless radio frequency, where the data would then go to a point-of-sale system, which exists currently in today's fuel stations. And then that data, the data there, the data, the identification of the device and the mileage totals for each zone and the fuel purchase amount would be transferred to a central computer, and this is the only place where the Department of Transportation is involved, is receiving the data. And then the mileage fee rates are applied, and those rates go back to the fuel pump where the motorist pays a new charge, the mileage charge. And this whole thing was very quick in pilot test. It was very, very as simple as a credit card transaction. As you can see, the mileage charge is added to the fuel purchase amount, and the gas tax is deducted on this receipt that the motorist pays. Now, there was another element to our pilot test, which was area pricing. Our funding from the federal government required us to test whether this system could be used for congestion pricing. And so we designed a way for a higher charge during driving in, say, the Portland metropolitan area, where that's where the borders of the red borders there is, more Portland metropolitan area. And in fact, it did work very simply. So there's the ability to create a geographic zone as well as a temporal zone. Now, the results of the test were successful. The zone differentiating and mileage counting and transmission accuracy and transaction administration all worked quite well. We did use prototype equipment that hadn't been used in this manner before, and we had it manufactured in Corvallis under a short timeline and then installed by Car Toys on the vehicles. And so as a result, the equipment didn't work perfectly. It wasn't designed for commercial application yet, but it worked well enough to call it a success. So there needs to be more work done on identification of the vehicle with the fuel pump, although we already know how to solve that problem. The most heartening results were the fact that peak period driving reduced by 22%, and at the end of the test, we did a survey of the participants, and 91% of them said they'd be willing to keep the equipment in the car if the system were extended to all service stations statewide. So the fundamental lesson, however, we learned is retrofitting is difficult. Not every car comes with a standardized port or powering system like a computer does. It simply comes with different systems that the automakers create on their own. And so it doesn't appear as though, at least right now, that the way to do this is to start putting devices in cars. The way to do this probably is to start with the auto manufacturers and have technology requirements given to them, and they choose the technology for the cars themselves that meet those requirements. And so this will be a transition over a period of time. Now, let's talk about the big issues. These are the ones everybody wants to talk about anyway, and boy, do I know about these, because I've had to deal with the public, the media, and some of you as well on these issues, and so I'm very well versed in them. And now these issues are being discussed nationally as this topic has gone to Congress and elsewhere. Let's talk about privacy. I have some new slides here. This one some of you have seen before, but this is to facilitate understanding of what is possible and what's not possible. You saw this one earlier. A lot of people think that there's a signal going out from the device in the car that the satellite can pick up to follow the car around. This technology does not work that way. It simply does not. It never has in any application. There is, however, for navigation units, which are GPS-based, there is a signal going out from them. And that's how the provider can follow you around, help you if you have a call star or a car stall or, say, a theft or something like that. In the Oregon test, we did not want to follow anyone around. It just wasn't something we were interested in doing. I said, privacy is an issue. Let's eliminate that. So there is no signal going out anybody can pick up. There is also no detailed travel map in the system. People call it a GIS map. That's what you find in a navigation unit, so that the system can say which road you're on. In the Oregon model, we didn't have a travel map. No GIS maps in the system. All there were in the system was the coordinates of the state. So when you pass through those coordinates, now the device knows I'm in that state and starts counting miles from the odometer. There's no travel history developed like a navigation unit. Simply not there. All we had was simply, this is an actual view of the screen that was in the pilot test. All we have were mileage totals for the zones that were created for the test. So it's simply a running odometer in those areas. The point I want to make to the committee is that you can create a privacy protection ability for a system that can fit anywhere on a privacy continuum. You do not have to have total invasion of privacy for this system. In fact, you could have no privacy in the system, which is what the Puget Sound study did. They used GPS receivers and basically a navigation unit and did follow people around. They had a signal going out. They wanted the data because they were trying to test the validity of congestion pricing. They were not trying to implement a new system. Since we were trying to work on a new system, we eliminated the privacy concerns as much as possible and still maintain an ability to audit and have the motorist challenge a bill. And so while we could have absolute privacy, basically have the device reset itself at the pump, there was no way to know if somebody was trying to cheat the system. And so with those three pieces of information I talked about that were transferred, which is the identification of the vehicle, the mileage totals, and the fuel purchase amount, an agency could identify whether there was an anomaly in the system and then go check out the anomaly. But there simply would be no way to know where anybody was driving or to develop a history for anybody, where anybody was driving. Okay, let's talk about the rate structure. A lot of people assume that there will be a flat rate. And so this is basically a flat rate comparison graph with the gas tax. The flat rate is obvious. It's the pink line. You have the fuel efficiency miles per gallon along the bottom, and then the charge per 100 miles on the left. And the gas tax, of course, you see it has that arc where more people who have fuel-inefficient vehicles pay more gas tax, and people who have fuel-efficient vehicles pay very little gas tax. And over time, of course, as people move to more fuel-efficient vehicles, you can understand the problem that will occur. Well, what happens with the flat rate is people quickly jump to the conclusion, and this is an accurate conclusion, that the losers are the ones on the high end, the fuel-efficient vehicles, and the winners are the ones on the low end, the fuel-inefficient vehicles. And, of course, this bothers people on the upper end or people that think that people should drive fuel-efficient vehicles. And I've talked to them many times on the phone, in emails, and in, going to people's houses, the people I know. And they get on my case about this. You can pretty much get them to, you have a basic responsibility to pay for the road system. You should pay a minimal amount. But then they say, yeah, but the Hummer driver. And they can't take that. So you have to figure out, if you want to resolve this question, and believe me, it's a question for you to resolve. All I can do is provide options and possibilities. If you want to resolve it, you have to do something different. Here's a possibility. I came up with this one. The idea is you have a multiplier against the base rate, against, say, the flat rate. And the multiplier would be, low at the high end. Say at 42 miles per gallon, you'd have a 1.0 multiplier. And then as you go farther down, you'd have a multiplier that is higher, resulting in more a higher payment. This would create that arc of the gas tax, but maintaining the revenue on the upper end for the flat rate. So anybody above 42 miles per gallon would pay based on a 1.0 multiplier times whatever the base rate is. That's one option. Another option might be to have a motorist pay whatever is the highest number, whether it be the gas tax payment or the mileage charge payment. That's also very possible. In fact, just about any rate structure you want to think about is possible here because you're dealing with computers. Now, ordinarily, this would be something for the revenue committees to work with because they're used to looking at, spreadsheets and all that kind of thing. But I think you'd probably get the point. Okay, rural driving. Probably the third biggest issue I hear about is rural drivers will pay more, and that's not fair. And so there's a kind of a view that they ought to be subsidized. Whether that's true or not is a legislative decision. I mean, also hearing about it nationally about drivers in California, by the way. Same thing. But the question is really premature, because without knowing what basically the rate structure is, you can't tell whether the rural motorists will be getting a deal or not. You don't know. In fact, if it's a flat rate, rural motorists that tend to drive more working rigs and heavier vehicles would probably get a deal, and say urban motorists that drive Prius or future electric cars may not. But that's all for it really depends upon what a legislature wants to do.
So, Jim, wouldn't you say that they already are under the
Madam Chair, in many respects, yes. The gas tax is a mileage charge. It's one that is failing because it cannot sustain itself over time as people move to fuel-efficient vehicles. But it is a mileage charge. Yes, it is. Okay, public acceptance. This is probably the most interesting topic. I've read a lot of blogs because whenever I have a Google alert and I see all the news alert and I see everything that comes up, every news story in the country and all the blogs and comments, and I know exactly what the issues are, and it's kind of odd, but there's a jump immediately to inaccuracies or tend to be inaccuracies and things like they're going to track us. It's going to be a flat rate, and so it'll remove completely the incentive to buy a fuel-efficient vehicle, all sorts of things like that. It's going to be a big, complex government bureaucracy. I hear all that stuff. But what I also know is that they don't know what we did or what the legislature might intend.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sorry.
Right here. That's okay. Can we attach these things to bicycles? That's an attempt at levity, Madam Chair. considering the press that was on TV over the weekend.
Yeah.
Forgive me.
I don't really have an answer, Madam Chair.
He'd be happy to do a pilot program for
you.
It might be more popular.
Thanks for saving me, Madam Chair.
But I will say that the biggest difficulty with this issue is the public doesn't seem to understand the problem we are trying to address here, that this is a failed gas tax system that cannot sustain itself over time. And until they understand the problem, they'll never accept the solution. And then, of course, they have to understand the solution. So it's a matter of communication. It may be necessary to have an actual proposal. And I talk to people all the time about this. I think what people are reacting to, after doing this for over 6 years now, is the fact that they don't know what it is. And so they tend to imagine what it is. It's like walking in the dark in unfamiliar territory. What do you see? Your imagination sees things. That's what this seems to be like. I always thought the flexibility of this system, the fact that it could create possibilities and that the legislature has total flexibility, was a strength. Now I'm starting to see it as a weakness. Because until the public actually sees what the system is and knows what it can do, you're going to have these reactions. And so I almost think we missed a step in the development of this. After we chose the mileage charge, and between the mileage charge and the pilot project, we probably should have come back and said, legislature, please constrain us with policies. Please do it. So that now we can point to law and say, no, we can't do that. Because law says we can't. And so we designed a system to avoid it. That may be what's necessary.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you. So is your perception based upon a study or just upon your observations? Because it's hugely interesting to me, having gone out into the public and just in a short time heard a lot of the arguments I'm sure you've heard over all these years. Yes. So study or just your observation?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, we don't have a study. I think it's advisable to do a study. Far prior to implementation. In fact, if policies were adopted, probably coincident with the policies. But in essence, I don't have a study that where I've got quantifiable data. But I have a lot of data internally. I mean, a lot of data internally. So I can tell you what this is not a wild assessment at all. Okay, what do we have to do before we actually implement such a system? A lot of things. First of all, policy decisions made by the legislature is one. And then, we tested one system. There are many, many ways to put this together. The generation of the location of the vehicle doesn't have to be GPS, for example. There are other systems. The reason GPS isn't really GPS, it's basically a receiver of satellite signals. GPS is something grander. But something like that works is because it covers the globe. If you use Wi-Fi or if you use, say, cellular, you're missing parts of the system. That doesn't mean it can't be solved. It's just that there's a reason why the satellite receivers were used. But you have to finalize things like that. How will the data be transferred? Have to finalize things like that. The device must be secure. The system must be secure. Otherwise, you don't want to implement it. The protection of privacy, I think, has to be something that's very important to protect. Other issues. This system that was tested in Oregon was designed for vehicles that fueled at commercial fueling stations. So we kept the operations cost really low because we're using an existing system. And so the gas tax cost about $1 million a year to operate for a $400 million plus revenue stream. Mileage charge could have the same revenue stream ultimately and an operation cost of about maybe $2-2.5 million. So it's very close, very advisable that way. But for vehicles that do not fuel at commercial stations, you've got to have a different system. Now, there are people in this nation trying to develop a centralized collection system where people get a monthly bill and use that, and so it covers all vehicles. We tested that. We didn't test it. We costed that out, and it was like $50 million a year to operate. So central collections is probably not where we'd want to go as a state, but we do need to have a different system for, say, electric vehicles when they come. And, again, legislative determinations of a rate structure, public education communications will be essential, and then finally run a broad-scale implementation test at the right time. There's a lot of legislative policies to consider. I just came up with a list here quickly. This is not in my ordinary slide, but there's a lot of things that basically have to be decided by a legislature. The level of privacy protection, you have to set a target, we have to hit it. Is it a replacement or augmentation of the gas tax? What are the basic requirements for technology? Are we going to retrofit or not? All of this changes the system developed. What are the cost targets? Is it going to be expensive or inexpensive to operate and put in place? What is the rate structure? Should there be subsidies from one motorist class to another? How do we ensure enforcement and all the attributes there, penalties, et cetera? Must there be an ability to audit and challenge a billing? Transition. Is a long transition acceptable? Or do we have to work for something that's very quick? And then are you going to add things to it, like congestion pricing or local option? Those are things that do not have to be added to a basic mileage charge system, but can be. There are alternatives. This is probably the first time before this committee this legislature I brought this up. But there may be an interim method that can be done a lot quicker. It doesn't involve a GPS system at all. There's no GPS receiver involved. But it is not accurate. It's an estimate. And for that reason, may have objections by the public. Basically, I'll describe it briefly. It has what's known as an AVI device embedded, say, in the windshield or in the license plate. And there's a company that makes this license plate right now. An AVI device is something used in modern toll roads. It costs about $8. It's an automatic vehicle identification chip. That's all it does. It's like electronic license plate. You go to the pump, and that device is read so that the motorist is known. That information plus the fuel purchase amount then goes to the central computer where the mileage, the fuel efficiency rating for the car is married with that data. Multiply fuel efficiency times the gallons purchased, and you get a mileage estimate. You pay the rates there. It would cover out-of-state miles, which the task force did not want to do. The task force wanted to cover only in-state miles. But it would be a system that could be put into place in a fairly short period of time. We're estimating, say, 4 years at the outside from go. It does involve this satellite receiver, and so therefore may be more acceptable. And as an interim measure, if you wanted to take a step in between this and a long-term system, it's something that could be possibly worthwhile and worth considering. You're not alone. There are a lot of states in the country and Congress now looking deeply into this. In fact, I probably don't even know all of them. These are the ones I know about because they've either called me or I've spoken in their state or I've seen a media report. A lot of them are simply in preliminary exploration. Some are based on want to have a self-reporting of mileage data, say at DMV, and that's how they want to do it. Those are the ones in orange. And then some are proposing a pilot project. And then only one has completed a pilot project, and that's Oregon. There's a lot of national support now for mileage charges. In 2007, in the fall, we had the first national commission created by Congress, the Policy and Revenue Study Commission, that endorsed the development and movement towards mileage charges nationally. And then this fall, we had the ASHTO, American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, endorse moving to mileage charging, and then also at the same time, National Conference of State Legislatures. And then just last month, the 26th of February, and you read all about this, I'm sure, the Infrastructure Financing Commission came forward with an excellent report that probably had the best assessment of this I've seen up to date. We also have key members of Congress talking about it openly in public session. Barbara Boxer, the Environment and Public Works Committee Chairman in the Senate, the chief member of the Senate in charge of the transportation, basically said we ought to move to a mileage charge, although she's looking at a way that isn't involving the GPS receivers. But also Congressman Oberstar, the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and then Peter DeFazio, the chairman of the Subcommittee on Highways and Transit, also both endorsed moving to a mileage charge. Oberstar wants to move to a passenger-based system right away, as a matter of fact, and Peter DeFazio would like to start with commercial vehicles. Because of a testimony I gave before the House Subcommittee on Highways and Transit, chaired by Peter DeFazio, and they asked what they should do next in the testimony. We came up with a recommendation to Congress and gave it to them. Basically, we said that it's very difficult for a single state to implement this alone. There's a lot of challenges, a lot of national industries. Theoretically, it could be done. There's nothing barring it. It's just difficult. It'd be helpful if we had a national investigation that confirmed the technology, that confirmed the system, and actually provided, say, the framework for any state to develop the system. It helps for a number of ways. And we also recommended an approach for national development, complete with a timeline. We had a short timeline, like 6 years. I wanted to push them. And the Infrastructure Financing Commission now said 10 years for that. But there should be national-level project teams as well as concurrent investigations going on so this could be done as quickly as possible and the pilot programs in other states. We have the final report that's been read widely. We did try to do a good job and make it so it was readable. And it seems like it is being read all over the country. So I hope I hit everything that was interesting. But if the committee has any questions, I'm ready to answer.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Woody, thank you again for another foray onto this topic. I'm on your slide, or at least I will be in a second, around the rate structure and externality multiplier option. I find that really interesting. There's laughter on the dais.
Yes.
Maybe I'm the only one.
Hey, man, I'm going to talk about it too. So,
is it correct to say that these devices could potentially measure, or a related device could potentially measure, the real-time miles per gallon as opposed to having it sort of pre-scaled by the average fuel efficiency of the car? So as I accelerate or as I coast?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, the devices we used in a pilot test had no capability like that.
Okay.
Although I think that is possible, they would probably be fairly expensive. I think it is possible.
Is that so? My understanding is that what you are suggesting here, that we have, or that it come pre-scaled by the average fuel efficiency?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, No, I'm actually proposing nothing. I am suggesting that there are numerous ways to do this.
Got
and
it.
This is just simply one cute way I designed. My car gets, my Jetta diesel gets 42 miles per gallon, so that's why the 42 is the soft rate. But there's just a lot of different possibilities here. What I was envisioning was a database that basically is a DMV database already. We know what the cars people are driving. That's known. It's part of the existing database. You associate that with some kind of fuel efficiency rating for the car, and then you could have the rate adjusted or the multiplier assigned that way. But there probably are many, many other ways to do it. That was just what I was in my head.
Follow-up, Madam Chair? I think it's more than cute. I think it's very interesting, for a number of reasons. It would seem to me that such a system would obviously incent fuel efficiency, but it would also seem to promote safe driving. Going 55 miles an hour would cost less than going 65 or 70 or 80, and it would also seem to scale the amount of revenue with congestion to some degree. If you're stuck in traffic and you're burning a lot of gas, and you're getting low miles to the gallon, for every mile, you're probably paying more into the system.
Madam Chair, Representative Beyer, Bailey, now that you think about it, there is a way to do, because you'd have the gallons purchased at the same time you'd have the miles driven, and so you could have fuel efficiency, real-time fuel efficiency for the vehicles. I'm sorry. I was kind of stuck on the VMT estimate for a moment, but you're right. You could have real-time fuel efficiency. That's true.
Final follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
Is there an advantage to trying to incorporate these kinds of externalities into the VMT process, or is it better to look at some other process for incorporating the externality into driving, say, you know, carbon fees or various things?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, you know, it's a matter of public policy. All I'm doing is suggesting that this could be designed in a way that encourages fuel efficiency selections and driving for motorists. Other policies, I'm not here to weigh this versus a carbon tax or anything like that, but just it's a real possibility. That's all I'm suggesting.
Thank you.
I have Representative Schaffler, Representative Widener, Edwards, and Benz. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I get up very early in the morning to avoid congestion, and then I tend to get here in a pretty quick pace. So I'm not sure what Representative Bailey's talking about is something I'm interested in, because I try to avoid congestion. But well, God knows it'll probably happen. But on the I like this chart better because I'm right here, and I won't be paying too much. On this one right here, I've had the benefit of my good, brilliant friend here next to me, too. By the way, the privacy part, I mean, I have a cell phone, and I understand, and I can believe him, I'm sure I can, that I'm sharing my data all the time if I have my roaming device on. And if I have a GPS in my vehicle, which I don't have one in my current vehicle, but I've had rental cars, and I love them, I'm constantly in contact, sharing exactly where I am. And I think that those two comparisons need to be shared with those folks that are scared about this, because in all likelihood, they have one or both already, and they don't even realize that they're sharing their data. So that's pretty much settled it for me as far as privacy goes. And my daughter, I definitely want her to have GPS on her car. And hopefully Daddy can monitor that. But she's a great kid. I'd just so Daddy knows where it is. On this chart right here on Channel 7, on page 17, if I remember correctly, when this state started to monitor and test and approve through DEQ to get your tags, your emissions, I think there was a cutoff date for the age of the vehicle, and if the vehicle was older than that, you didn't have to go through DEQ, and then it was slowly phased out until now. I think only truly antique vehicles that the permit's only good for a certain number of miles a year. But essentially everyone has to, but it was a long phase in, which I tend to think would not be a bad idea to help ease the pain and concerns of people. But on this graph here, I really, like, if I had a truck for years, an old 82 Chevy pickup that I wrenched on myself, that I could fix myself. It didn't get good gas mileage, probably 8 miles on a good day, but I could beat the crap out of it, which I did, rather than going and buying a nice modern vehicle, which I couldn't scratch up. But over the years, I probably would have saved a considerable amount of money had I purchased a vehicle that got better gas mileage and was more efficient. But for various reasons, I didn't. And I think this will encourage people to do just that. But I think this right here is a little steep. I would flatten that red line out a little bit initially, and then over time, increase that. Because slowly people will phase out these old trucks. I no longer have that old truck. I bought a car when I got this job. My wife said, you can't have both. It's one or the other. So now I have a nice newer truck, which I'm scared to death of scratching. And it's just a 2000. So I really would like to see, and then I would like to know how much money, where that line is, and then how much money we make relative to where that line is, if you have that kind of data someday.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, this is something where you're going to be looking at spreadsheet after spreadsheet to decide where those lines ought to go. But because we're dealing with computers here, and basically computer and vehicles where the characteristics of the vehicles are known, we have them now. We don't have to go get them. We have them. Any sort of structure can be developed. I could even see, I probably shouldn't go off on a tangent like this, but I can see, say, certain working vehicles because they may be getting a deal because they are not, they're heavy by necessity. Or at least we don't have Priuses for you know, people that go out and do yard work or something. So those kinds of things could be developed into the system. But we've only begun to start thinking about this.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going through looking at everything that you've done here, have you? Because the thing that we're worried about are electric cars coming into play, I think, is the big thing behind this, mm-hmm. Correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, we know of vehicles that are going to push 100 miles per gallon coming pretty soon.
Okay, which I knew about some of those coming. So, but to me, it seems like we want people to get more efficient cars, and the mileage tax pretty well covers that. So rather than making people invest in all this other technology, because it almost seems like what we're doing is creating a stimulus package for the guys who make these devices for monitoring where the car's been and the miles that are traveled. And if we're doing it at the gas pump, if someone buys an electric car, they don't go buy a gas pump. So you're still not going to catch them. So to me, it seems like it'd be easier to just do a flat rate if someone buys an electric car of $30 a month or $40 a month. I know I probably spend about roughly $20 a week in fuel taxes myself. So, but just coming to a flat rate, and it'd be a lot easier than everything that we're trying to do here, wouldn't you think?
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, this is a matter for, again, the legislature to argue through and come to a decision on whether the system should be flat or not. I'm simply raising alternatives. I do want to point out, though, based on something you said, the device we used in our pilot test is very similar to what people take in the woods to walk around and not get lost. Hunters know about these devices, and they know they can't be tracked. They know they can't be tracked because there's no signal going from the device, but they simply don't want to get lost. That's the device we use, basically, here. So I know I see on blogs and I see in poorly written news reports that this is a tracking device, but that is something that's poor journalism.
Yeah, the tracking part I'm not concerned about. It's just the fact that someone's going to have to go purchase the device. And the other thing you have to look at are people coming from Washington. There's a lot of people that commute into Oregon from Washington to work every day. Now, yeah, what are we going to do about situations like that? Because our gas tax is lower than theirs, and our fuel is cheaper down here, so they're buying their fuel here and going back to Washington.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, two things. Those devices that you take out in the woods are very inexpensive right now. And the device we would use for this purpose probably is going to be in two digits. I understand they're approaching two digits right now. So it's not something that's outrageous. You can buy a navigation unit that's incredibly expensive. I'm sorry, what was your second point?
Well, the other point was people coming in and out of the state as well.
Okay, yes.
So two digits, $90 times 3 million, well, not that many cars, but adds up.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, probably during the phase-in period, there's going to be two systems going at once, the mileage charge system and the gas tax system. And one of the best things about what we tested is it tested that a vehicle that's not equipped would simply pay the gas tax. It defaults to the gas tax. And so that's what an out-of-stater would do. Over time, when all Oregonians are on the mileage charge system, probably the gas tax may well increase to probably encourage local people from out-of-state to get a retrofit device. But these are issues that raise the question of should we take this on nationally. And I think that it's better looked at nationally than having having one state do one thing and another state do another thing.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given that we're some years away from widespread deployment of the in-vehicle technology, in your opinion, is there a low-tech or no-tech alternative that we should consider?
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, there's really two possibilities. One is the paper and pencil method. Everybody reports. That will probably require a fairly large increase in the bureaucracy, frankly, to do that, because you got to make sure people report, you got to make sure they report accurately, you got to go after people that don't report, you got to have a public face. There's a lot of bodies involved with that process. The second best method is the one I mentioned with the AVI chip. You don't have to go in the vehicle. It's basically external to the vehicle. License plate issuance, a lot less. You're not required to work with the manufacturers. So it could be a lot. That's why you could probably do it in about 4 years.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up.
And then, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, the Governor's Jobs and Transportation Act contains an experiment for congestion pricing. I'm curious how you see that playing out. What's a potential design for that experiment?
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, probably we would have to look at congestion pricing systems that are already in play in the world, rather than this kind of a system. I think that it would probably be worthy to see if we could have some a pilot test of this system within that more traditional congestion pricing system, just to show the world that this group of vehicles could manage it that way. Mm-hmm. But it's we have to design that. We haven't done it yet.
Okay. Thank you. And you don't need to. All right. Given that, thank you so much for coming today. And thanks to the people that sat through it before. Hopefully they picked up a little more information today. And we are adjourned.